Welcome to the Layer 8 Podcast, Season 2. This season, we'll again hear from the experts. These experts are social engineers and open source intelligence investigators. Sometimes, they'll tell us stories about their experiences, and sometimes we'll have some questions for them. We hope you'll enjoy them.
For this episode, we welcome Philip Wiley. Philip is an offensive security instructor at INE and founder of the Pwn School Project. Philip also co-authored a book, The Pentester Blueprint, Starting a Career as an Ethical Hacker, with Kim Crawley. Philip tells us some great stories of his career transition into InfoSec and his podcast, The Uncommon Journey, he hosts with Alyssa Miller and Chloe Mizdahi. We also get to hear stories from Philip's professional wrestling career and how he made out the time he fought a 750-pound bear. Let's hear from Philip.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Layer 8 Podcast. We got an exciting interview guest for you today. We have Philip Wiley here to talk about some of the things that he does and let you know some of the fun that he has. Welcome to this episode, Philip.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be joining you. Kind of where I got my start was way back years ago before I got into technology. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life when I graduated high school. And my friends told me you should be a pro wrestler. So I competed in powerlifting. So it kind of made sense to me because I was in the gym a lot and liked working out. So being a pro wrestler sounded like a good idea. So I went to wrestling school, wrestled for a few years, and decided I needed a more stable career because I got married in 88. So I needed something more stable. So I'd worked retail sales. I had worked manual labor. I'd put up fences before. All sorts of things, but nothing I really liked. And I'm one of those kind of people that I didn't know at the time, but found out later I have to be passionate about what I do. I just can't show up for a job, go through the paces and all that. So I ended up going to a trade school and learned AutoCAD and became a CAD draftsman. And through my CAD drafting career, I found out that I had more of a knack for the computer side of things. Because in 93 and 94, when I was going through this, I did not have any exposure to computers, didn't know how to use one. And so from learning how to use computers in class and then working in different places. These places I worked at didn't have dedicated IT staff. So I would end up fixing things. I figured out how to fix it. So I taught myself how to build computers and ended up taking a Novell NetWare operating system course because during my career as a draftsman, I found out what these consultants were being billed out at. You know, they're being billed out $50 an hour. We were being billed out at $30 an hour. We were making half of that. So I figured these guys are making more money than me, and what they do sounds a lot more interesting. So I got started as a sysadmin, did that for 6 years, moved into security in January of 2004, doing network security. So we all did the same thing at the time. There were like four of us on the team. We all did firewall, IDS, risk assessments, and some network vulnerability scanning. And then in 2005, the company hired a new CISO, and he came in and kind of put us into different silos to match at the time what more modern security organizations look like. And so fortunately, I got put into application security. And so by moving into application security, I was using web application vulnerability scanners and found out that I was really interested in penetration testing. So in 2012, when I got laid off from my job, I got a job working consulting as a pen tester. And so that's where I really found this is like out of all the things I did, as I was going through my career, I was passionate about it and liked it, but this is like one of the areas that I liked and stayed in it the longest. So, you know, coming up on March, we'll make 9 years of pen testing experience. So I really like it. I like to teach it. So along the way, I started teaching at Dallas College in 2018 and really found out that I was passionate about teaching because I like to mentor. And so this gave me a way to do it on a broader scale and give me exposure to people that I didn't know, people coming through the school system here in Dallas. So I did that and then started the Pwn School Project, which is like a monthly education-based meetup, which we went virtual back in 2019. I was offering as kind of a hybrid that way to reach people that weren't local. And then fortunately that worked out because when the pandemic hit in 2020, then we were all used to streaming. So we went 100% virtual. And so in towards the end of last year, I got more into the education side of things, and I work for INE now as a offensive security instructor. So I really enjoy teaching. And for the longest time, I never thought I would get away from pure pen testing and get into education part, but I really enjoy mentoring and teaching others. So it's been a good change for me. I've always been really competitive and really pushed myself in recent years. Like as I got older, I kind of realized, you know, the world needs coaches and mentors and teachers. And I found out that I was a lot better in that area than, you know, doing the trade itself. Sometimes it takes the patience. And so that change has been good. It's been very enjoyable. It's nice to be able to help people out and share my passion. So.
Wow. That's a pretty, pretty interesting background. You always hear in this industry that so many people come from different places. You just kind of mentioned that you came from professional wrestling. I actually came from professional baseball. I don't have any kind of real background or training in IT or anything. I actually have 2 degrees in sports medicine, and somehow that's gotten me to the pen test field as well. Do you see a lot of the people that kind of come to you either through Pwn School or through the colleges? Do they have diverse backgrounds as well? Or are you seeing a lot of just the typical college age students doing it?
It's pretty diverse, because I offered my class as continuing ed too, because I knew when we started the class, I developed the curriculum in first semester. We used Georgia Weedman's book, but then went, you know, because in 2018, middle of the year, towards the end of the year, CompTIA came out with the Pentest Plus curriculum. So we went to that to offer students a certification to train for. But what I found is I knew a lot of people in the community, and they found out I was teaching the course, so they came through the course. So I had a lot of people that were continuing ed. Maybe they already had a college degree, or they just wanted to learn how to pen test. So a big majority of the people coming through the class were non-traditional students. But in the past year or so, the college has, the person who was running the internship program left the college, so they quit offering internships. So my class is a requirement to graduate. So it's kind of shifted to more traditional students. But the ones I really enjoy teaching are the people that are interested in learning how to pen test, because I enjoy doing workshops at conferences and that sort of thing. So the non-traditional students are fun. Just anyone that's interested in learning, you know, even the traditional students, I have some that come along that are interested in it. But a lot of the students coming through need it for their degree, and they're not so concerned with learning. But it's really interesting to see. I've had a really talented student. He was in high school still, that lives in East Texas, that took my class and really did well. And while he's going through the class, he met someone else that was a developer, and he was able to get a job, you know, while he was right when he graduated high school. So yeah, it's a lot of fun. And like I said, it's usually non-traditional people. And those are the more interesting stories, because you see people come through that have worked in different areas. We had one of the very first classes that I taught. And one of the things I love is the students that actually get jobs in pen testing. So far, I've had like 7 over the past 3 years get jobs actually in pen testing in other areas of security. But this person was like late 40s, early 50s. Her kids were in college. Some of them were through, and she didn't have any technical experience. She had like a computer science degree and had been going to college, taking a lot of different cybersecurity courses, different development courses. So she really had that good background, but she really didn't want to do an internship and work for free, which is understandable. So I was able to help her get a job. And so that was really great to see. And the cool thing is, each semester is the people that really work hard. You see the ones that get the jobs because they put in the extra effort. They're putting in the long hours in the labs. They're doing stuff outside of class and getting involved in the community. And one of the things I've done too is it's a way to get people involved in the community, because each semester I tell them about conferences and the different meetups. And so they get involved. And so it's really interesting to see. And some of the students have gone on to speak at conferences. So I got to see one of my students speak at a conference back in 2019. And so it's been a lot of fun. One of the cool things is, you know, as a competitive person or someone that really likes to achieve, do a lot of things, like success in your life, you know, you can amplify that when you're helping other people. So it's a great feeling to see other people reach their goals, get jobs in the field and that sort of thing.
That's great. And I really like how you mentioned Georgia's book. That's like one of the main resources that I like to point out to people, especially when they're trying to get started in pen testing. It's like, that seems to be a great book to start with. And it, also along the lines of starting out, lots of people will often ask, like, how do I get started in the IT security field? Or how do I get started in pen testing? And often the advice that I like to give to people who don't have any kind of experience is first learn how to build before you learn how to break. What's been kind of your experience where now you're teaching pen testing to the college students that are of normal college age, the 18 to 22 year olds? Do they have any kind of building background? Like you mentioned in your introduction that you've been like a network engineer. You learned how to build networks before you did pen testing. I was a application developer for 12, 15 years before I became a pen tester. What are you seeing in that way with the college students looking to become pen testers? Do they have any kind of building background? And if they don't, is that any kind of a hindrance to them?
Yeah, I like that you mentioned building, because the very first job I had as a pen tester going in, I knew how to use vulnerability scanners, had a background of security and sysadmin background, but didn't have the hacking background. But it was interesting because our manager was always teaching us to build stuff. And that's how I got my start, because when I would come home from work in my IT days, I would come home and I taught myself how to do web design. So I actually had an Apache web server running on Red Hat Linux. So I actually hosted my clients' websites at home. It set up SendMail to do mail relay for their email addresses. And so I hosted all that at home. So I learned, you know, I taught myself a lot of that. So I do share sometimes with students, learn how to build. So if you're wanting to do a web app, be a web app pen tester, if you really want to be really good at it, go through something like Free Code Camp and learn some kind of web design. You know, if you can learn how to, because Free Code Camp goes from HTML, CSS, and some JavaScript to some of the JavaScript backends and stuff. So it's a really good way to learn. But as far as students coming in learning, I've had students that get jobs in pen testing without any kind of IT background. But one of the things I always share is don't let that hold you up. Don't, you know, apply for other things too, because it's going to be easier to get a pen tester job if you were even help desk, desktop support, you know, sysadmin. It's going to be easier to get that experience because that all helps. Like you said, you need to learn how to build. And so one of the things I do, because I have this lecture that I gave first semester that's turned into a conference talk. And actually, I gave it at B-Sides Boston, the Pentester Blueprint, and which is actually a book now. But one of the things I show is, you know, I share my background because I was a sysadmin. I moved into security. I knew these things before I started pen testing. If I didn't have the sysadmin background, I wouldn't understand the networking and the operating systems to be able to do that. So you have to understand how to build, how to secure, to be able to break into it. So if you understand the security and how things work, it's going to be easier to be able to hack into it. And some of the best pen testers and hackers I know, they do a lot of reading the manuals. If they're on a pen test, they find a particular web server, you know, maybe IBM WebSphere that they hadn't used before, they go through and read the documentation to understand it before they get in there. So I think it's really good to understand the basics. You don't have to understand all the different web servers, but if you have a basic understanding, then you can learn new ones. And so, yeah, I've had students. It was interesting. One of the most surprising students I had, and I always encourage, never discourage anyone, even if they say it sounds far-fetched, I support them because you don't know when it's going to work. I had a student came through my class that wanted to be he was a traditional college student, and he said, you know, I want to be as good as you, but I want to get there sooner. And I said, good, that's good. You know, work hard and you can do that. I've seen people that became really good pen testers in no time. And one of the people you're familiar with is TinkerSec. You know, I know Tinker when he was getting started out, and that guy took off, and in like no time, he became a really great pen tester and social engineer. But I never discouraged him, but this student came up and said, yeah, I told him, yeah, you could do this. You just have to work hard for the time. About a week or two out of the class, you know, he was kind of tired of the reading assignments, and he said, do I have to read all these assignments to be a pen tester? And I told him, I said, work on the labs, spend a lot of time in labs, learn how to do the hands-on stuff, the stuff you like, and then you can still learn it. And he comes around like in the fall semester, or right before fall, and he got a job as a pen tester. And so one of the things sometimes people, it's just, you know, one of the things that happens to us as we get older, when you're younger, especially when you're a kid, you think you can do anything. But as we go through life, we have bad experiences, we have failures, or people tell us we can't do something. And, you know, we end up being our worst enemy. And so we put those barriers on ourselves sometime. And so I never impose barriers on anyone. I let them, if it's an impossible dream, let them go for it. You may be able to do it anyway.
Yeah, I think you kind of hit upon something there that I've also thought about. I'm thinking Philip and I are probably about the same age, from the same generation. And I don't know if you feel this same way, Philip, but it seems like the like you were just talking about, the younger ones, the probably in their early to mid-20s, they really think they can do anything. Nobody's going to stop them, which when I was that age, it was probably more the opposite. I always kind of looked for permission from older people to kind of do things like, can I do this sort of thing? Am I allowed to do this kind of thing? And if somebody's like, no, you can't do that, it's like, okay, you're an authority, you're right. Where now it seems like the opposite. If somebody tells a 24, 25 year old, no, you can't do that, they're going to be like, watch me. Is that the kind of thing that you see with them?
I kind of see that. And that's one of the things I see about our generation is a lot of times, you know, I guess I think gatekeeping was a lot stronger back years ago, because I remember when I started in IT, you would have this Unix administrator that knew so much and they didn't really want to share with anyone because they felt like it was their job security. They looked like the ninja, the guru, and they didn't want to give that up to anyone else. And so you saw a lot of that. But I see a lot of the people coming in, and I think maybe over the years, people are being more supportive, and I like this. And that's one of the things I had to learn, because the generation we grew up in, you had people telling you not to do stuff. Some of your mentors and stuff were kind of harsh and then kind of give you the tough love. And one of the things I've learned is you just got to be, you know, kinder, gentler. And, you know, because I've just learned from, you know, my own daughter, some of the things she's gone through in life is you just have to talk to them in different ways. And I think it's better. I mean, it's better than what we had, you know, because I remember football coaches and stuff, they would just, you know, yell at you and treat you a certain way. And then you had certain mentors or people, you know, as you're coming up, they were kind of harsh about stuff. And, you know, I had, you know, I was wanting to be a pro wrestler. I had one of my uncles that was telling me, you can't make money as a wrestler, really trying to discourage me and stuff. And I don't think he really meant to try to discourage me, but, you know, we just got to be more supportive. And that's kind of my approach. But I see a lot of these people coming in wanting to do stuff. I mean, there are some that are kind of more than thing I see that they're holding students back sometimes is like public speaking. And one of the things I really try to encourage students to do is public speaking, because one of the things that really changed my life was it was right around the call for papers for the 2013 B-Sides Dallas-Fort Worth. One of the coordinators at one of the local meetups said the best job he got of his career was from speaking at a conference. And when I heard that, I went the next week, signed up for Toastmasters. They helped me overcome my fear of speaking. And then through teaching and speaking at conferences and doing workshops, I totally got over that being scared, that shyness of speaking. So that's one of the things I see, probably the biggest thing I see with the younger generations is they've gotten so used to social media, not interacting in person. So those soft skills, developing those soft skills, building up the courage to speak in public and that sort of thing, what I see are really the biggest challenges.
Yeah, interesting that you kind of bring that up as well. That's how I made my transformation from a developer into security, was just through a presentation. I just kind of found an exploit or a compromise that we had at the place that I was working at the time, and thought it was pretty neat the way that it all happened, and wrote that up into a presentation. You mentioned the soft skills, and I think a lot of people, when they want to get into pen testing, they think they need to be just an elite hacker that knows all the zero-day attacks. One of the things that I often see is that people that come in and know all those types of things might not have some of the more non-technical skills. What do you think are some of the most valuable non-technical skills that somebody looking to get into penetration testing would benefit from learning about?
Writing, definitely, because you have to write a lot of reports, and it's not so much, you know, just writing the report. You need to learn how to communicate. You may have proper grammar, but you need to really know how to communicate what you found on the pen test. The better you can describe that in your report, the better. And that's going to make it easier for you on the debriefing or closeout calls when you're going through the pen test. If you really document things well, list all the steps, and really explain that in really easy to understand language, then it's going to make your life easier, because if they have to ask you a lot of questions and that makes the calls a little more difficult, they can go over and review those pen test reports beforehand and have more targeted questions. So there's not a lot of questions on things that should have been well explained. And just communication in general, sending emails, one of the things I've seen too with people that get used to text message is make sure you're using complete sentences and punctuation, capitalization, that, for one thing, you want to be taken seriously. You know, a lot of times management doesn't appreciate your elite hacking skills, but they do, you know, appreciate, and you gain the respect by being able to communicate properly, you know, use proper grammar, punctuation, and capitalization and that sort of thing. Because you see people over the years, you know, past few years, I've seen people send emails and things wouldn't have caps, or they would leave out punctuation or not complete sentences. So you have to get away from the texting mentality and, you know, write full sentences and proper punctuation and so forth.
Yeah, I think one of the best phrases that I've heard recently, I'm pretty sure Tinker said this. I don't know if he was the first one, but he said, "I hack for free and I get paid to write reports." I think a lot of pen testers come into the field thinking it the other way around, that they're really there to do all the fun hacking, and then the reporting is just kind of something extra with that.
Yeah, that's definitely a good way to put it, because at the end of the day, that's the only proof they have outside of some logs that you did the pen test. And, you know, you really need to document the remediation plan and all that too, because it's, you know, you can put what the information in the minimal, but I've found that the customer appreciates it more the more information you give them on remediation instead of just the basic output that you find from your vulnerability scanner or looking at the different CVEs online. You better remediation, the better. And that's one of the things too, is learn the blue side. If you really can learn how to do the remediation better and explain how to do that, people are going to want you to do their pen test, and you're going to form better alliances with the blue team during your pen tests.
So earlier you mentioned that you have a book about the pen tester's blueprint and that it was a conference presentation. What is really in your book and what was in your presentation that people should probably go check out if they might be interested in that type of thing?
Yeah, it's interesting because this talk actually was my first day lecture of class each semester. And as I gave this lecture, some of the other professors at the school asked me to come in and talk to their security classes about pen testing. And so this was like, you know, starting out the first semester, you know, the spring semester in 2018. And by November during B-Size DFW, I turned into a conference talk. And so basically what I tell people in the book is the prerequisite knowledge you need before you begin. So understanding networking, operating systems, and that sort of thing, the thing you need before you even start learning how to hack. And then, you know, showing, you know, the different courses and stuff that can help you, the different certifications on there. And Kim Crawley was my co-author on that book, and she brought a lot of good things to the book. She did interviews with different people in the industry, how they built their home labs, you know, different tips from them getting into pen testing. So they share those, which are very valuable. And she even uses like some examples of how, you know, someone working as a waiter or waitress or a barista, how those skills can help as a pen tester, the things you learn, you know, knowing those industries. And a good example of that was like some social engineering I've had to do before when I was consulting. I had a company that we had, our pretext was to have them go to a website that we built, enter their credentials. And so I would tell them that, okay, we had some patches fail, but you need to go log into this website server and it'll check to see if your patches were installed properly. And from working in IT and having that support background, I was able to you know, communicate that to the people. And then when I ran across people questioning me, I was able to react in a way that was believable that I was, you know, someone from the help desk or desktop support. Because one of the guys came up and there was a Outlook issue going on at the time that would keep prompting you to log in. It was a normal kind of thing. And this guy was asking about that problem, and I was able to talk him through those issues. So I was able to play off my pretext and, you know, kind of keep up the act that I had going there based on experience. So there was, you know, different roles that you're playing. So if you were, you know, someone that worked for a telco company, and if you worked as, you know, a cable installer or something like that, then you can use that in the field, you know.
Kind of along those same lines that you just mentioned, social engineering and teaching. One of the other people that I partner with is Professor Anshul Rege at Temple University, where this past year we put together a social engineering capture the flag competition for college students. I'm wondering, when you are teaching the college students or even in your Pwn school, are you teaching them social engineering, and how much of your curriculum or classes do you teach them social engineering and any kind of fun stuff that you do with the college students with that type of thing?
We really hadn't gone too far in depth. There was some project we did one time, one of the very first projects I had students do was to come up with a doppelganger domain, something that would look like another domain that had sent an email, and then write like a sample phishing email. And so one of the cool things we really did in class, you know, more of the physical security side of things, but Mobius from the Dallas Hackers Association meetup, she runs the lockpick village there. And so I'd have her come in and do lockpicking lessons. So we've done that. And I used to have Tinker come in and talk to my class on, you know, he's got a talk he does, and he does a lot of social engineering. So they would get some good stories that way, you know, because he's really great at the social engineering. So he would come in and share that information.
And with your Pwn School, what types of things are you teaching in that? I think you mentioned before that there's all different types of people that take the class. Who is the typical type of person that might be interested in that? And what type of things do they learn? And where do they go from there?
Yeah, kind of a little background on how Pwn School was formed. My first semester, it was getting down towards the end of class. The college I teach at, the only offensive security class we had was the ethical hacking class. And so students were asking me, what do we do next? And so I was kind of thinking about maybe, you know, it was fun, especially the students that really got into it, was interested in the subject. I thought, you know, we could get together on weekends or something and do unofficial classes, you know, do some projects, build some different things like, you know, build your own Raspberry Pi or that sort of thing. And I was thinking along the lines of that. And I had a couple students that were trying to get my summer semester class, and they were having to transfer into the college to take the class. So they weren't able to get in. So I was really disappointed that they didn't get in. They were really big in the community and really, really sweet kids. And so at that point, I thought I need to figure out a way to offer education that it's not going to restrict people from, you know, cost or registration process. So when I started the Pwn School project, I intended on teaching a lesson each meetup myself, and was prepared to do that. But once I mentioned this and shared it on Twitter and LinkedIn, people from the community said, hey, I want to present there. And so what it does, you know, not everyone's got the time to run a meetup on their own each month, but everyone has, you know, maybe an hour or two each year or something that they want to give back. And so that's kind of how it started out. So I've presented some myself on pen testing. It was originally offensive security topics to start out with, but it's kind of gone into more areas. So we had someone that did a really great talk on how to become a SOC analyst. We've had people do talks on mobile pen testing, you know, different types of defense. And we had someone that did like a scam the scammer talk, where the company they work for, someone was scamming their company or trying to scam their customers, and how he was doing research, tracking down these people, communicating with them, trying to get information to possibly lead to some kind of arrest, you know, to capture these people for doing wrong. So we've had all sorts of people come in here. We actually had Benton from TrustedSec came and did a workshop in our Denton meetup, because they used to be physical. And so he did a workshop on pen testing there. So we've had various different people speaking. And now, since it's gone complete virtual for now, we've had people from all over give presentations. I had someone from India one time do a talk on Docker. And then we have people from, you know, the community throughout the US and stuff doing talks. So it really started out, it's really kind of more of a meetup type format. We've had some workshops, but it's more education-based. So we try to keep it from being too technical. So someone that's just trying to find an area of security to move into, they understand it enough that they can learn something from it.
That sounds really exciting, a lot of fun. And since this podcast often focuses on social engineering and OSINT, you mentioned a couple things in your introduction that I thought might be a little bit of a crossover. You've done some things in your life that seem like overlap with social engineering a little bit. I'm guessing that most people listening to this are at least familiar with professional wrestling and the way that kind of thing works. And one of the things that really struck me when I knew that I was going to get to talk to you was that most times when we do social engineering, it's a one-on-one kind of thing. Whether that's going to be through a phish, or we're trying to get physical entry into a building, or even just a phone call, that's usually a one-on-one thing. What really impresses me, I think, about the social engineering that professional wrestlers do is that they get entire arenas of people to follow along. Do you also kind of see an overlap of social engineering and professional wrestling and being able to get people to either love you or hate you or anything like that, just to be able to get an emotion out of people? Did you also see that kind of thing as well?
Yes, definitely. And it was pretty interesting because one of the terms we used in wrestling when, you know, you're getting beat up and hurt was selling it. So you're really trying to convince people you're really getting hurt, you know, because sometimes if you're wrestling someone that's really good, they could look like they're going to knock the heck out of you and not touch you or barely touch you. But then there's some people that were kind of stiff that they hit you and you felt it. But yeah, so just trying to sell that. So you kind of learn from that because, you know, you're the good guy, you're trying to get people to sympathize with you. And then I never really wrestled as a bad guy, but then, you know, seeing the way some of those guys worked it, they really got people mad at them and, you know, really just got the attention and brought people out to the matches. So yeah. And, you know, social engineering, it's kind of acting. So it's acting both areas. And one of the things I would do, and it would probably help be a better social engineer and it would have been a better wrestler, if I had things to do over again, I probably would have taken some acting classes. I mean, even speaking in Toastmasters would have helped me as a wrestler because I was kind of shy and what few opportunities I ever had that I did any kind of talking, you know, really wasn't my best. But, you know, if, you know, would have had some acting lessons, I think that would have helped speaking too. You know, anyone I know some really good speakers or people with a theater background, people that can tell stories. I mean, look at Tinker. He's a great storyteller. So anytime you get an opportunity to hear him speak, he makes it really interesting.
Yeah. One of the things that we do at the Layer 8 conference the last couple of years is we've offered improv classes. How much of the wrestling experience, whether that was in the ring or doing interviews, was improvisational, where you had to kind of figure it out on the spot? And maybe more so with the interviews, I have no idea how much when you go on the microphone is pre-planned versus just figuring it out, whatever is happening at the moment.
Yeah, any experience I had, you had to wing it. And that was a little more difficult. And you mentioning the improv, it was kind of interesting because Wirefall, the guy that was the founder and one of the co-hosts of Dallas Hackers Association, him and some other people, I think it was earlier last year before the pandemic hit, they took an improv class, you know, to kind of help with speaking and stuff. But yeah, there's, as far as the wrestling thing goes, there's improvisation. And the wrestling thing, you know, it's not as planned out sometimes as you think there would be, because I was wrestling Michael Hayes, one of the fabulous Freebirds, and the television tapings went to Saturdays. So this is a Saturday morning after he had been out Friday night drinking and had a hangover. It was going to be a pretty short match. So they asked him, do you want shorter wrestling time, longer interview time, or the other way around? So he wasn't feeling so great. So it was a really short match of him beating me up and me making him look real good, and longer interview time because he didn't want to be jostled around a lot after being out drinking all night.
And how much do you think would people benefit from taking a Toastmasters class when it comes to something like social engineering? Like, maybe some people don't even know what Toastmasters is. Do you want to talk briefly about what Toastmasters is and maybe how that helped you and whether you think that could help with somebody looking to become a social engineer?
Yeah, I think it would definitely, because if you're shy, you know, talking to people, then, you know, when you're doing, you know, a pretext, you're social engineering someone, you kind of need a script. So if you're not good at reading that script, I mean, you're not going to be able to read the script, but to be able to repeat that script and not sound robotic and planned, then you need experience with speaking. But one of the things that was really helpful about Toastmasters that people don't really get to see, Toastmasters is a organization that you meet like weekly, on a weekly basis. They've got a couple different books that you go through, different manuals. One is a leadership manual. And this is some of the things most people may not see the value in, but it was very helpful because they teach you how to lead meetings. So you're organized, run meetings, you send out the agenda, you actually, you know, turn over control for different portions of the meetings. And so each one of these manuals, you do the leadership manual, and then there's also like the speaking manual. So you get these different speeches that you give, and people critique you while you're doing these talks, and it really helps you become a better speaker because they go through afterwards and tell you you've used too many ums or different filler words. And when you're doing any other talking in the meeting, they will use some kind of device, a clicker device or a bell or something to ring when you say or use too many ands and that sort of thing. So they help break you of that. But one of the good things about the meeting is the impromptu speaking portion. So they come up with a topic that will be something you have no idea about, and you've got to speak about that topic for 2 minutes. the impromptu speaking. And so this gives you some of that improv experience. So it was very helpful. And I could see where, you know, really one of the things I should probably look in going into the future is doing more of that, you know, because the impromptu speaking is really good to be able to just think of stuff on your toes.
Also with the social engineering and some of the things that you described, you said that you did some sales way back in the beginning of your career. Did you ever also kind of see any overlap between social engineering and doing sales? I know some people look at social engineering as being like a negative and manipulation where, you know, once you start really learning about it, you kind of learn like, no, manipulation is usually going to be outside the scope of social engineering. So if we say manipulation is out and all the other social engineering skills are in, did you see any kind of overlap with the social engineering skills and being a sales rep?
Yeah, I could definitely see that because I worked for a place for a while selling fitness equipment. I did that for a period of time and I worked in a jewelry store. And interesting thing is that I'm really a competitive, goal-oriented person. So I worked in this jewelry store because one of the things I did is get them to trust me and just kind of build that rapport. And, you know, one of the things that I've done through a lot of my career is get people to like me. So just getting people to, you know, I don't try to fake being nice, but just be generally nice to people. So just trying to build that rapport and get them to trust you is kind of helpful. And one of the things I did as a salesman when I worked in a jewelry store, I know the people in a jewelry store would probably not, you know, probably a good thing I never told them that, but I would tell them the truth on whether it's a good price or not. Cause we had another jewelry store in the mall that the owners of the jewelry chain ran that store. This other one was a new chain they were coming out with. They were hoping to be like the next Zell's jewelry store. And if I knew they'd go to the other store and get a better deal, I would try to help them out opposed to just making the money. So I was able to build that trust. And so they knew when they bought from me, I was trying to help their best interest. I wasn't just trying to make a buck. And I would be honest about that. And one of the first lessons we did that was in sales is we would always give people the benefits of why they should buy this certain type of ink pen and learn how to describe those things. But yeah, one of the main things was just building that trust and building a rapport. And that's one of the things too, just working in IT or working as a pen tester or anything, you know, you're dealing with customers, learn to be nice to them, because if you're a jerk, then you're not going to get, you know, compliance from them. If you're a consultant, they're not going to want you back, or maybe your company's working for them, but they may request that you're not on the project because you, you know, have a bad attitude or something. So just getting people to like you, build that trust.
Not related to anything else that we've talked about. I've heard rumors, and I think you might have even alluded to it in your introduction, something about wrestling a bear. I've never heard that story. Is that a story that you would want to tell about how you wrestled a bear one time?
Yes. And where that all came about is when I was wrestling professionally, I was wrestling like once a week at the most, and it wasn't enough to make a living off of. So my full-time job was working as a bouncer in a nightclub in my hometown of Denton, Texas. And the people that ran the bar Thursdays through Saturday nights, they'd have a band in there, and, you know, they had to pay for the bands to be there. And usually they found out on Sundays they would lose money if they had bands. So they would come up with other forms of entertainment. And so they decided to bring this wrestling bear in there. So since I was a hometown person, worked in the nightclub and was a pro wrestler, they thought they'd bring in this wrestling bear. So anyone could wrestle it, but they put my wrestling promo picture on the posters to try to draw people in. So it was open to anyone to wrestle. And so I actually ended up wrestling the bear twice. I've got a picture of me wrestling the bear, but it was a pretty interesting experience because this bear really knew how to wrestle. So the other people would go up. And if you look at the picture of me wrestling the bear, he would actually take his front leg and his paw and then pull your legs out from under you. And so when I saw this, you know, having some wrestling experience, I knew to get down lower to get my center of gravity in a better spot and then get my feet out. So it'd be hard for him to grab my legs and harder for him to take me down. So, but he actually, the second time I wrestled, he ended up biting my ring finger. So my finger was in his mouth and the trainer was telling me, you know, be still, I'll get your finger out. And I wasn't having any part of that. I pulled my finger out because I thought maybe by the time they get my finger out, this bear may have already bitten part of it off. So,
how big was this bear? Was it something you could pick up?
No, it was 750 pounds. It was, I forget, was a black bear, brown bear, which one of the two is bigger? It's a 750 pound bear. And I really wished I should have talked to the bartender that took pictures and got the negatives, or either got more pictures taken. I got the best one, I thought, but there was one of them. And at the time I was like 250 or 260. And this bear, there's one angle where you see the bear, his head is wider than my back. So it's a huge, huge bear. So it was an interesting experience. I mean, it's like trying to push a parked car. If you ever, you know, try to push a car that's parked, it'll just barely move at all. That's what it was like. This bear is nearly impossible to move him. But it was interesting the way they trained the bear. A lot of those wrestling bears would stand on their hind legs, and it was easier for people to take the bear down. But this one, they trained to sit down because the broader base, it was harder for you to take the bear down. So he's really difficult to wrestle. But one of the cool things about it, a couple other interesting facts, one of the guys that was, you can see in the picture of the referee, but then there was a guy further back that was holding a leash. They had a chain that they had the bear leash. So I guess if something happened, they use it to kind of try to control the bear. But the guy that was holding the chain actually worked on a prison riot squad. He worked at the Fort Worth Federal Prison. And so anytime prison riots broke out, this guy got sent down. So you can kind of see why they had him handling the bear. And he actually wrestled bears too. So that was kind of an interesting story. But anyway, he was on the prison riot squad. But also they shared a story. They said that I did better against that bear than anyone else had at that time. And Joe Klecko, that used to play for the New York Jets, had actually wrestled that bear once. So I don't know if they were just trying to make me feel good or what, but I felt pretty good that I did better against the bear than he did.
Yeah, I can't even imagine if you, a professional wrestler, was faced off with the bear, and it sounds like struggling to kind of hold your own a little bit with it, what just some average person off the street would do against this bear.
Yeah, it'd be pretty difficult because, you know, back then in my younger days, you know, I competed in powerlifting, so I was, you know, I bench pressed like over 400 pounds, you know, I'm a 700 pound deadlifter. And so, you know, I used to do curls with 200 pounds. So yeah, some of these other skinny cowboys that were wrestling that bear at that same time, because there's a country Western club called the Yellow Rose. So some of these guys would go up there and he took them down pretty easy, you know, because they were, you know, most of these guys maybe 160 pounds at the most or so. And here I was like 250 or 260.
Yeah, those guys were just an appetizer for that bear.
Yeah. Yeah, these are the kind of people you normally kick out of the nightclub because they decide to usually find the biggest guy in the nightclub and go after him and end up getting kicked out. And he wasn't muzzled either. That's one interesting thing, because some of the bears, they put muzzles on them to prevent them from biting. But they said they trained this bear without a muzzle, because what happens with those bears that have muzzles is they would headbutt you. They'd use their head instead. And so they found it was just safer to have the bear unmuzzled.
That's pretty scary to think that a headbutt is worse than a bear bite.
Yeah. The scary thing about it was, I didn't even think about it at the time, no one had ever taken this bear down. And I was an exception to the rule. I couldn't take the bear down either. But I thought about after the fact, what would have happened if I would have taken that bear down and he hadn't been taken down before, and those wild instincts kick in. That could have ended bad.
Yeah, what if somehow hurt the bear or scared it?
Yeah, I could have got hurt. And knocked my head off or mauled me.
That's a great story. So is there anything else that you would want to share with people about things they can check out that you're working on, anything that they can do, or any other type of advice that you'd like to give to people?
Yeah, I have a podcast called The Uncommon Journey Podcast with Alyssa Miller and Chloe Mastagi. So if you're getting started in security, then this is definitely one that you need to check out, because, you know, Alyssa started out as a pre-med student. Chloe had kind of a humanitarian political science background. And so we have interesting people in all the time. We've had like Alyssa Knight, Chris Kubeka on, we've also had Insider PhD on there. We've had Farah from Bug Crowd. We've had Ray Redacted on. He was one of our first guests. So we've had a bunch of different people, and they've had interesting ways to get in. And so I really recommend it, because, you know, you may be doing who knows what right now, and it just kind of shows you that other people have really succeeded and come in from, you know, unusual backgrounds to get into the industry.
Well, that's a whole lot of fun. And I want to say thank you, Philip Wiley, for joining us on this podcast episode. This is a whole lot of fun hearing all of your stories and things that you've worked on along the way. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. I had a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to the Layer 8 podcast. You can find out more information about us at layer8conference.com and find more podcast episodes on many of your favorite platforms. We hope you enjoy these episodes as much as we enjoyed making them.